Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Everybody, Richard Martin here, Richard Martin's wake-up call. Just a quick word about Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. There will be no engineer to process the talks, so a recording of one of the archives will be made available to you from my hours, and I will be back with you in a week's time next Tuesday. I thought I'd start today with a little story of a builder who did it right. For once, somebody who actually saw the writing on the wall and took evasive action and will, in all probability, survive the downturn. So let's hear from him. Let's see what we have here in terms of home builder Roger Pollock, who got a little too excited with Portland's frothy housing market. That's Portland, Oregon. Now he's cashing out for whatever his homes will fetch. Pollock's Lake Oswego company, Buena Vista Custom Homes, built too many houses during the boom in towns from Scappoose to Happy Valley to Bend. Next month, Pollock will put all 230 of his unsold homes and condos up for a two-day auction. The asking prices have ranged from $300,000 to $650,000. The bids will start as low as $69,000. He said in his statement, "We were over-aggressive and too slow to react to the changes in the market, and that has created an oversupply of finished homes." Well, Mr. Pollock has obviously seen the light, and he will survive. His strategy is in stark contrast to that of Lennar, that's our Miami homegrown variety, whose mothball housing strategy is doomed to fail. Lennar has simply decided that if the prices are too low, he just won't sell. He'll hold on to them. Yes, I'm sure he'll pay all the taxes, maintenance, and everything else, but he will behave like a spoiled child, and he will not relinquish his toys unless he gets what he wants. Lennar, needless to say, has the biggest case of home builder denial ever. So going back to Mr. Pollock here, Roger Pollock, 46 years old, of Lake Oswego, said life was good during the boom. He sold as many as 50 homes a month as late as spring 2006. Each sale netted Pollock's company an average of $150,000 in profit. "We made more money than I could ever dream in the last few years," Pollock said in an interview. But the boom went bust this summer. Well, I'm sure this is not news to Mr. Pollock, but all bubbles eventually do pop. The bubbles in Seattle, Vancouver, and Toronto will eventually pop as well. Pollock said he's current on all his construction loans, and he isn't in danger of bankruptcy. But he decided he'd be better off taking a hit now with an auction than suffering a slow bleed with interest payments on construction loans as he struggles to sell off inventory. Homes at auctions elsewhere have sold for about 40% of the original asking price. Pollock said the same figure would be realistic here. He wants to clear all his inventory by the end of the year, and even if it's very possible, the company will lose money in the process. "We'll pretty much do whatever it takes," Pollock said. Despite the auction, Pollock plans to start new subdivisions early next year in Tigard, Oregon City, southwest Portland, and Happy Valley. Only this time, Pollock said, he'll build only after he has a buyer on the hook. Well, this is a winning strategy. Pollock will live to fight again. Okay, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. And we are coming to you live from Miami, Florida, through the studios in New York City of Progressive Radio Network. If you wish to contact me in private, you can call me on my direct line at 305-357-5575. Let me repeat that. It is 305-357-5575. If you would like to send me an email, please do so by writing to rmartin@gscorporation.com. I will repeat that. All one word, please. The corporation should be written out in full. The G for global, the S for strategic. That's Global Strategic Investments in Miami, where I am currently talking to you from. And please remember to write in lowercase. Okay, once more. rmartin@gscorporation.com. And then please call me or call us, all of us here at the radio station, toll-free when you have a question or a comment that you wish to add by calling 1-888-873-4643. I repeat, 888-873-4643. That's the number of the studio, and you will be put on hold until a convenient break in the proceedings, at which point I will then invite you to state your case. Okay, today I thought I would recount one of the rather large and scary breakdowns or meltdowns that we've seen in history. And it comes from the year 1907, and it has recently been the subject of a book. It's a very good book, by the way. It's called The Panic of 1907 by Robert Bruner and Sean Carr. Again, I'll read the title of the book. It's just come out recently. It's called The Panic of 1907, and the name is Bruner and Carr. That's B-R-U-N-E-R and C-A-R-R. That's Robert Bruner and Sean Carr. So I thought I'd give you a brief resume of what exactly happened, because the similarities between what happened then and what I think is happening right now is really quite alarming. And what you will, I think, get from it is more a question of how greed and hubris take over rather than good sense, something which did not happen in the case of our friend Mr. Pollock of the construction company, who very simply decided that the market knew better than he did and that he would follow the market rather than expect the market to follow him. So this is actually from an article by Chris Mayer, and I think it's well worth studying. So sit back and enjoy the story. Picture this. On one side of the negotiating table was Frederick Augustus Heinze, the illustrious American copper magnate. The boy wonder was only 29, but already a celebrity among the business barons of the day. The Brooklyn-born entrepreneur was, by all accounts, brilliant, uncompromising, dashing, and very rich. On the other side of the table was Walter Howe Aldridge, a bright metallurgist representing the Canadian Pacific Railroad. At issue between them was a copper smelter Heinze owned in Trail, British Columbia, along with a short line railroad called the Columbia and Western. The Canadian Pacific Railroad was feeling its oats about it this time, having generated a substantial profit the year before, its trains laden with incoming settlers and freight. Flush with cash to invest, the railroad had visions of expanding across Western Canada, hauling coal, coke, wheat, machinery, lumber, and metals across the resource-rich region. The Canadian Pacific was interested in Heinz's rail because it fit nicely in their plans. Late in 1897, they made an offer for it. Heinz, though, wouldn't sell just the railroad. He would sell the whole shebang, smelter and rail, or he wouldn't sell at all. His asking price was $1.2 million. Heinz was running a bluff. His Canadian operations were not doing so well, and his American interests demanded his attention. The trail operations outlook was not bright either, with the threat of competing smelters being built in the area. The railroad wanted the C&W badly enough, however, and finally agreed to include the smelter in their offer. Now they were struggling to meet Heinz's price. The two negotiators worked late into the cold night of February 11, 1898, and reached an impasse. Heinz offered to play poker for the difference, which is about $300,000. Aldrich, wisely, I think, declined. Heinz had a reputation as a good poker player. Eventually, the railroad swallowed hard and met Heinz's price. Just like that, the Canadian Pacific Railroad was in the smelter business. Aldrich stayed on as managing director of the company that the railroad created to house the smelter. Under Aldrich's direction, the smelter not only supplied copper, but was also putting out pure lead and fine gold and silver by 1902. Flush with cash from the sale, Heinz moved to New York and became involved in banks and trusts, a move which would lead to his undoing. Most men gamble with her, meaning fortune, Ralph Waldo Emerson once observed, and gain all and lose all as her wheel rolls. Heinz, not content to live with his riches, made a bid for more. In the early 1900s, most banks were prohibited from taking on trust accounts, wills, estates, etc., by their charters. Trust companies were specifically set up to deal with this business. Though initially trusts were regarded as safe haven investments, they eventually became highly speculative. They were like today's hedge funds of their day. And like the hedge funds of today, trusts became heavily invested in the stock market using extreme leverage or borrowed money. They didn't keep much in the way of reserves and were susceptible to sudden adverse changes in stock prices. Also, trust company directors were often involved in banks, and the banks, though they couldn't do trust business, could own trusts. As a result, there was this web of connected relationships between some of the large speculators and the banks. This was not so different from the way the now infamous hedge fund long-term capital management was intertwined with many of the nation's financial institutions when it failed in 1998, threatening to take the whole financial system with it before a bailout was arranged. So when, on October the 16th, 1907, the price of United Copper closed at $15, down 76% from its high only 2 days earlier, the headlines the next day were grim. Copper breaks Heinzer, blared the Boston Post. Heinzer was heavily invested in United Copper. If Heinzer were only a copper speculator, history might have been quite different. But Heinzer owned a bank and was associated with a number of other banks. He was president of Mercantile National Bank, for example, a position that he promptly relinquished as his plight became public. But it didn't prevent a run by Mercantile's depositors in the wake of the news, as depositors scrambled to get their money for fear that the bank might be involved with Heinz's losses. Other banks rallied around Mercantile and supported it, however, which helped it weather the storm. Heinz's bank, Butte Savings Bank, failed the next day, as did the brokerage owned by his brother. The real backbreaker was when the Knickerbocker Trust Company in New York experienced a run on its deposits. Its president, Charles Barney, was an associate of Heinzer. Knickerbocker had 18,000 depositors, and in a matter of hours, worried depositors had skinned the Knickerbocker for some $8 million. No one came to Knickerbocker's aid, not even the great J.P. Morgan, who would assist other troubled banks during the crisis. Some historians believe that this was part of a deliberate campaign by the banks to destroy the credibility of the trusts. The banks felt threatened by the growth of the trusts and reasoned that if the Knickerbocker failed, the public would lose faith in the trusts and the banks would gain. Plus, a man like Heinzer had many enemies eager to capitalize on his plight. Or perhaps Morgan didn't like what he saw in Knickerbocker and thought it was beyond help. In any event, Barney, Knickerbocker's president, shot himself dead that night, and the Knickerbocker Trust didn't open for business the next day. Runs began in earnest, hitting banks and trusts all over New York. As one historian put it, the financial fires that were intended to ruin Heinzer and the trust companies quickly roared out of control, and the panic of 1907 became a non-discriminatory economic catastrophe for the entire nation. The spark for the panic of 1907 may have been a personal vendetta gone awry. As Glasscock observes, F. Augustus Heinzer was to the panic of 1907 as the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was to the World War. Even so, the panic of 1907 was like many of the crises that went before it and would happen after it. It was inevitable, because highly leveraged and overextended lenders and speculators lead to eventual ruin. The panic of 1907 was not the worst financial crisis in American finance, but it was critically important because the forces in favor of creating a national bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, would gain strength, and the tide of public opinion increasingly supported the idea. As a lender of last resort, the Federal Reserve Bank would bail out failed banks and thereby stem future panics. The Federal Reserve Bank was established in 1913. The real problem was that the banks had been allowed to renege on their obligations to redeem their deposits in gold. This allowed them to inflate, to pyramid deposits and loans on a smaller and smaller base of gold. The excess funds created fueled speculation in the market. Failure was unavoidable in such situations. Today, with a Federal Reserve Bank and deposit insurance, we seem to have done away with the quaint notion of a bank run. Instead, we suffered near continuous debasement of our currency, a mostly gradual but sure erosion in purchasing power. We suffer from debts and deficits that would be impossible under a strict gold standard. Who is the better for it? The panic of 1907 broke Heinzer at the age of 37. With former partnerships broken, millions lost, his reputation in tatters, and nearly 2 years spent on legal battles, Heinzer was exonerated, the defeated Copper King headed back to Butte, where he was welcomed as a hero, with an automobile procession and a live band celebrating his return. In Montana, he would live out his final years rehabilitating some of his remaining mines. His health, though, was failing. In 1914, only 44 years old, he suffered a hemorrhage of the stomach caused by cirrhosis of the liver and died. His biographer, Sarah McNellis, writes, "There was discussion of establishing a scholarship or erecting a monument to retain his name and contribution to the city of Butte. After the initial shock of his death faded, however, the talk must have ceased. No such memorial was established. Today, Heinzer is almost forgotten." Stories such as that of Heinzer are intriguing because I see in these events so many parallels with today's markets. I have long been fascinated by the timeless qualities of finance, the constants of greed and speculation and easy money, which forge the familiar patterns of boom and bust. "Easy money makes a wild town," Glasscock observes. It also makes for a wild stock market. In the Knickerbocker Trust, you have what may be a metaphor for Fannie Mae, a large but troubled financial institution whose failure could also spark a wider financial panic. Like the Knickerbocker Trust, Fannie Mae is no favorite of the banks, which claim that Fannie's special privileges give it an unfair advantage in the mortgage business. Those who have been bullied by Fannie in the past would shed no tears should it get stuck in a financial pickle. In Heinzer, you see any number of beleaguered executives, men who tasted early success, rode it to create brilliant fortunes, only to be forced to resign in disgrace, with much of their empires disintegrated. These tales are classic tragedies, told again and again in the dusty tomes of financial history, with new ones being written nearly every day. Well, ladies and gentlemen, just for your information, the stock of Fannie Mae is down exactly 25% today as I am speaking to you. It's actually now down 25.23%. I don't think anybody talking today could have read anything more prescient than the story that I have just read to you. Well, with that piece of joy, we ought perhaps to talk about what we need to confront, which is most certainly a severe recession, which is now increasingly clear to be inevitable within the next few months. You know, those of us who warned for the last 12 months about a combination of worsening housing recession, severe credit crunch, and financial meltdown, high oil prices, and a savingless and debt-burdened consumers being on the ropes causing an economy-wide recession, were repeatedly rebuffed by the consensus view about a soft landing given the presumed resilience of the U.S. consumer. But the evidence is now building that an ugly recession is inevitable. You may remember Morgan Stanley's Stephen Roach, who used to be the in-house bear, while Richard Berner, by the way, a most sophisticated economist and analyst, was the in-house soft landing optimist. Well, now, Roach has been spun off to Morgan Stanley's Asia operation as the head of the concern there. And so the commentary by Richard Berner has become increasingly darker. And the latest Monday piece by Berner is entitled "The Perfect Storm for the U.S. Consumer," where he points out the headwind forces hitting the U.S. economy. I quote from him: "Serious pressures are mounting on the U.S. consumer on five fronts. Job growth is slowing. Surging energy and food quotes are draining purchasing power. Adjustable rate mortgages are resetting, lending standards are tightening, and housing wealth will likely decline. Do these dark clouds finally and ominously herald the perfect consumer storm?" And he concludes his piece with the following. He says, "Risks to the consumer are rising, and the risk of outright U.S. recession is higher now than at any time in the past 6 years. Housing is in sharp decline, consumers are vulnerable, and companies may cut capital spending and liquidate inventories. A strong contribution from global growth is still a huge positive, but spillovers from U.S. weakness to trading partners may hobble that lone source of strength. These pressures could last longer or be more intense than I expect. And even if the economy skirts overall recession, corporate earnings will likely decline." Ladies and gentlemen, this has to be, it has to be one of the most bearish reports I have ever read in advance of some kind of meltdown. This is serious beyond belief. You know, Nouriel Roubini has chimed in with a lot of this, and I agree with him when he says, "I now see the risk of a severe and worsening liquidity and credit crunch leading to a generalized meltdown of the financial system of a severity and magnitude like we have never observed before. In this extreme scenario, whose likelihood is increasing, we could see a generalized run on some banks and runs on a couple of weaker non-bank broker-dealers that may go bankrupt with severe and systemic ripple effects on a mass of highly leveraged derivative instruments that will lead to a seizure of the derivatives market. Think of LTCM to the power of 3. A collapse of the ABCP, that's asset-backed commercial paper market, and a disorderly collapse of the SIBs and conduits, massive losses on money market funds, with a run on both those sponsored by banks and those not sponsored by banks, with the latter at even more severe risk as the recent effective bailout of the former's losses by their sponsored banks is not available to those not backed by banks. Ever-growing defaults and losses, $500 billion plus, in subprime, near-prime, and prime mortgages with severe known knock-on effect and the RMBS and CDOs market, massive losses in consumer credit, auto loans, credit cards, severe problems and losses in commercial real estate and related CMBS, the drying up of liquidity and credit in a variety of asset-backed securities, putting the entire model of securitization at risk, runs on hedge funds and other financial institutions that do not have access to the Fed's lender of last resort support, a sharp increase in corporate defaults and credit spreads, and a massive process of re-intermediation into the banking system of activities that were until now altogether securitized. Man, let's take some reading. Some reading. Ladies and gentlemen, you are the privileged few. I cannot tell you how glad I am to be able to bring this information to you. You will find it nowhere else. This is, quite frankly, as bad as it gets. I mean, I am sitting here waiting for the storm. You are sitting here. You all have different financial situations, but we are all going to be involved with exactly the same destiny, which is a depression of a magnitude unthinkable in its extent. There comes a point where I have to sit back and say to you, good luck. I can only go so far. I can only give you so much advice. When the professionals like Nouriel Roubini, Richard Berner, these people from big organizations come out and speak like this, you have to know the writing is on the wall. This is unprecedented. The forces of finance in Wall Street maintain their charade up until the very last moment. In fact, they maintain it up through the last moment until things have already started to collapse. Fannie Mae, which, by the way, have immense problems that I won't go into, but they are basis inability of the consumer simply to service his mortgage. And that's what Fannie Mae does for a living. And now they're taking it full frontal. And it's a grim situation. The stock is down a quarter of its entire value in one morning. I don't know what else to say. This is truly epic. We are living through historic times, I will just be basically the messenger of the bad news until it's all over. I see no other way out. Nothing else will do. Wow, what a thought. Huh? Okay, let me give you my phone number again in case you would like to call in with some comment or question. The number here is 888-873-4643. Let me repeat it once more. 888-873-4643. Well, that was Fannie Mae's stock price. Let's have a look at Freddie Mac's price. Freddie Mac's stock price, ladies and gentlemen, Freddie Mac is down 33% as we speak. This, of course, in terms of those two stocks, outweighs the greatest crash the stock market has ever seen in 1987. The market fell 22% on that day. Fannie Mae is down 25%. Freddie Mac is down 33%. This is truly sobering. It takes my breath away, believe me. I don't see this very often, as in once in a lifetime, perhaps. Walt emailed me, and he says in his email, "Hi, Richard. There was an article in Barron's this weekend entitled Big Ben's Dumb Idea for Freddie and Fanny by Jim McTague. In the article, it stated that the, quote, markets treat the two titans as if their actions carry implicit guarantees despite annual denials from the Treasury. Today, it was reported that both had a combined loss of $10 billion. Those reporting the losses today on CNBC said the markets are not concerned because of the government guarantees the mortgages they issue. What is your opinion here? Have you heard about these annual denials by the Treasury?" I would have thought they were more like monthly denials, Walt, rather than annual denials, but no problem with that. Yes, indeed. You know, the concept is that Fannie Mae is guaranteed, which it is not. Freddie Mac is, in theory. But again, you know, where's the money? Who is going to pay out on all this? And what effect is this going to have on inflation? You know, these are all concomitant questions which, quite frankly, lead off from the basics here. Let's take George, who's a caller online. George, hello. What have you got for us, please?
Mr. Martin, it's a pleasure to speak to you again. My question is this. The banks are going to just start whipping out money like there's no tomorrow. Inflation's going to run rampant. What does the citizen do to keep up with this mess? Or how do we survive? Where do we put whatever capital we have left?
Oh, it's very easy, very simple. Put it into short-term treasury bills, George, and you'll be fine.
Because that's only going to give you like 4%.
Yes, but they go up. You see, they float up. And as interest rates go up, because they're short-term, because they keep maturing very quickly, it means that the next batch of treasury bills that comes out will be priced at a higher level in interest. Do you understand?
Yeah, I got you.
So long as you maintain short-term treasury investments, you will be protected against any increase in the interest and the inflation of money. Okay?
Looking at 6 month bills or 3 month bills?
3 month bills.
Great. Thank you, sir, for your help.
Not at all. 90 days, actually, if you like. You can make it 90 day bills. If you think interest rates are going up, if you think inflation is going to carry interest rates up, make it 90 day bills. You can buy those at the window. That's not a problem. Thanks, George. Olivia, North Carolina, are you online?
Hi, how are you?
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, hello. You're scaring the bejesus out of me. I'm a retiree, recently relocated to North Carolina from the East Coast, the Northeast Coast. And I have a pension, and I have about $200,000 in CDs. And that's going to be maturing next month. What do I do to ward off some of these dire predictions that you've given us?
Well, pretty much the same as what I said to George before you. Did you hear my conversation with George, Olivia?
Yes, intermittently.
Well, basically, you know, the United States Treasury puts out debt in varying maturities. Some of it is like 90 days. Some of it is 30 years, okay? So some of it is very, very quick maturity, and some of it goes out for, you know, a long, long, long time. What you're looking at is to put your money into these short maturities, which basically are fully, you know, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, which, by the way, only has to print money or to raise taxes to pay you off. So you're going to be fine, especially if it's only 90-day paper, which makes it the most senior of all the debt they pay. But at the same time, more importantly, if interest rates do rise, if money, in fact, does get printed as though it was going out of fashion, you will be protected because the rate of interest will float up every 90 days as you renew your treasury bills. So that's really the answer. Put the money into the treasury bills. I wouldn't go out and try and be clever and buy gold and things like that because gold is only a commodity. And quite frankly, if everybody has to sell gold in order to derive money with which to pay down their debts, gold isn't going to go very far. So be careful of anything else and don't buy any assets, don't maintain any assets. Just keep what you need to live and put the rest in treasury bills. That's my advice to you.
Well, thank you very much for that in-depth response. But one last question. How do you initiate the purchase of the treasury bills? Do I do it through a bank, or would I have to go through a broker, or how would I initiate that process?
Open an account with Treasury Direct, and you can do it directly with the Treasury. You don't have to go through any broker. You don't have to pay any fees. You do it immediately with the Treasury, and although you won't receive a certificate, you will receive a receipt, and your receipt with the Treasury is good for ID in terms of your investment. Also, when the time comes to roll them over, as we say, which simply means sell the present ones which are coming due and buying future ones simultaneously, your account with Treasury Direct will be able to process both of those trades. So that's the easiest way to do it. Okay?
I tell you what, you and Gary Knoll, you're the best. You two are the best. Thank you so much.
That's so sweet of you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Olivia. Steve in New Jersey, are you online?
Hello?
Steve, are you there?
Yeah. You mentioned a few weeks ago a pasta and peanut butter report, and I lived through that in the dot-com bust before I swallowed my pride and crashed with my mom for a few years. I was wondering if now is the time to get a second job while you can, even if it's a low-paying job at like a video store or something like that, and... is Canada going to be in the same exact predicament, or could you like move there for a few years and move back when it's over?
There are a lot of questions inherent in that, and a lot depends on your personal situation, your family situation. It's awfully hard to answer that kind of question, Steve. It's the kind of question, frankly, that I'd like to discuss with you personally over the phone, because you know I'd need a lot more information about your personal situation before I could even begin to give you coherent advice on that. But in a general sense, the United States is going to be a very difficult country to live in the next few years because it has to adjust its standard of living down. And you see, that's the problem for America. When they had busts in the past, the standard of living wasn't that high, so they didn't really have to experience such a huge hit to their way of life. Now, unfortunately, Americans are used to these second cars, these extra vacations in the sun, you know, the plasma TV, the private schools for the kids, the visits to Starbucks, the wife's visit to the beauty parlor. I mean, all these things are going to have to go. And as that happens, there will be tremendous social unrest, in my opinion. We're already seeing that in areas where foreclosures have basically rendered ghost towns of even fairly upscale communities where, you know, drug dealers are moving into houses. They break down the windows of these homes that have been abandoned in foreclosure. They rip the copper out of the infrastructure, which of course copper is very highly priced right now. They take away from all the fixtures and fittings, and then they just squat in the homes and just live there, which means that people living around them are afraid to go out at night. I mean, this is something which is fairly limited right now, but my contention is it's going to become widespread, and life is going to be very unpleasant in large swaths of this country. So if you have the opportunity to move to a calmer country like Canada or Australia or New Zealand, or if you want to take the plunge and go to Central America or even South America like Argentina, where, you know, they live very well in terms of, you know, their culture, and many people speak English, and, I mean, you can live, you know, fabulously well for about a third of the price of what it costs to live here. If you can be a little bit creative, then yes, by all means, do that. But, you know, again, you know, a lot depends on all kinds of other factors which would require me to know more. So do by all means give me a call, Steve, thanks anyway for your information. All right. Again, let me just give you my number again in case anybody else would like to call in. I really do enjoy these calls. I like it that people have issues, concerns. I think they're useful for everybody. I believe that everybody can gain something from, you know, everybody's concerns, and of course I don't know what those are, so I need you to call in and tell me. The call-in number here is 888-873-4643. Once more, let me give it to you. 888-873-4643. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what I like to call as subprime consumers. You know, when home prices skyrocketed in the early 2000s, everyone seemed to forget that the subprime borrowers were high risk by definition. Now that these losses are snowballing, the lenders are sort of belatedly rethinking the wisdom of making these loans in the first place. Similar conclusions will soon be reached by foreign nations that have supplied American consumers with goods that they cannot afford. So in reality, America is a nation of subprime consumers. You know, for most of recorded history, nations have paid for their imports with exports. When a nation runs a trade deficit and instead pays for imports with its own currency, it in effect issues an IOU to the seller to buy an exported good at a future date. After all, the currency of the nation running the deficit is only legal tender in the currency of issue, and is therefore useless to other nations unless it can be exchanged for goods in the issuing country or exchanged for other currencies. However, no matter how many times the currency is passed around, at some point, the final holder must spend the money on something in the issuing country. By providing goods in exchange for IOUs, foreign nations are in essence engaged in vendor financing. This concept came to mass attention during the dot-com boom when many telecommunications equipment companies sold their goods to cash-poor startups in exchange for credit or stock positions, in effect, IOUs. When the dot-coms went bust, the equipment providers were forced to restate earnings as losses. As the world surveys the landscape of the American economy, it will notice an industrial base too hollow to produce sufficient quantities of exportable consumer goods necessary to make good on our outstanding IOUs, U.S. dollars. As those dollars continue to lose value, those losses will suddenly become increasingly apparent. Just as lenders eventually figured out that loaning money to borrowers who couldn't pay them back was a bad idea, nations will discover that selling products to Americans who cannot afford to pay for them is just as foolish. Think about this. Currently, foreign tour operators are organizing shopping tours where foreign citizens fly to America for the specific purpose of buying goods cheaper here than they can buy the same goods in their own countries. Of course, most of the goods they are buying, such as clothing, electronics, jewelry, etc., were not made in America in the first place. How absurd is it for Italians to come to New York to buy Italian-made shoes cheaper than they can find them in Milan? Does it make sense for foreign producers to offer products to Americans for less than their own citizens? Of course not. In short order, the free market will correct this by raising prices here in America and lowering them in the rest of the world. Many naively believe that this scenario is unlikely, as foreigners will indefinitely prop up the U.S. economy in order to preserve their best export market. However, the same argument could have been made regarding mortgage lenders and subprime borrowers. After all, based on the outsized fees generated by subprime lending products, risky borrowers were clearly the mortgage industry's best customers. Given their profitability, why didn't lenders simply extend subprime borrowers even more credit to preserve the market? The obvious answer is that at some point, lenders discovered that the market was not worth preserving. They realized that the short-term profits came at the expense of far greater future losses. The same revelations are about to be made around the world as other nations realize that selling consumer goods to Americans is a losing proposition, as the profits they believe they are earning today will simply evaporate tomorrow. When that happens, just as subprime borrowers are losing access to mortgage credit, America's subprime consumers will find far fewer bargain basement imported products at their local Walmart. Be prepared for unthinkable conditions to be with us for quite some time, as in years, not months. This unprecedented global lending spree far exceeded the credit boom that preceded the Great Depression in terms of lending standards and malinvestments. It will not be resolved anytime soon. Let me repeat that, ladies and gentlemen. The unprecedented global lending spree that we see today far exceeded the credit boom that preceded the Great Depression in terms of lending standards and malinvestments. It will not be resolved anytime soon. In addition, creditability is hard to come by when the Fed pretends that problems do not exist. Credit default swaps that are tied to the banks are trading at the widest levels in at least 5 years. The contracts, which are a gauge of investors' perception of risk, pay the buyer face value in exchange for the underlying securities or the cash equivalent should a company fail to adhere to its debt agreements. A rise in the contracts signals a reduction in investor perception of credit quality. Citigroup contracts earlier this month reached the widest in at least 5 years, while Merrill Lynch touched the highest in at least 6 years, and that's from Credit Suisse Group. A basis point on a credit default swap contract protecting $10 million of debt from default for 5 years is equivalent to $1,000 a year. It's a bit bizarre, said Gunnar Stengel, head of index and bond strategy at Dresdner Kleinwort in London. We're in a state of exaggeration on the risk of banks compared to non-financials. Stengel is right. The Fed would not easily let Citigroup fail, but it could languish with impaired balance sheets for years, unable or unwilling to lend. Alternatively, Citigroup could be broken up into pieces and sold. The former is the Japanese deflation scenario, especially if the situation spreads beyond Citigroup. On the other hand, the Fed is not apt to be bailing out non-financials, which lends credence to the notion that things are a bit bizarre. However, as I said earlier, it's not that Citigroup debt is priced too high, it's that risk of default elsewhere is priced way too low. Here's the big question. Is the system so messed up that central banks everywhere will not really be able to bail out anyone? I think so. It's the price we have to pay for the most reckless global financial experiment in world history. Confidence in the Fed's, and central banks in general, ability to reflate is going to be shattered in due time. Well, we have something here. Let me see what this is. This is Rosemary Attica, who says, are Ginny Mae's okay? Yes, they are. Don't worry about it, Ro. You're fine. They're guaranteed, and so you should be perfectly okay. I wouldn't buy any more because I think that you have this inflation risk that we were talking about, but they're fine. Yep, okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Well, now, to conclude here, I don't think we have too much time, but I do believe that you need to know why we must have a recession. We have to have a recession. There is no question that there is no other way out. It is the only way, you know, to cleanse the system. Bernanke and Paulson won't admit it, and obviously investors hate recessions. But we must not remain trapped in this kind of outdated 1990s wishful thinking about a new economy and perpetual growth. You know, Jeremy Grantham's GMO firm manages $150 billion. And in his mid-year report, and I talk about Jeremy Grantham frequently, in his mid-year report before the credit crisis, he predicted, in 5 years, I expect that at least one major bank, broadly defined, will have failed and that up to half the hedge funds and a substantial percentage of the private equity firms in existence today will simply have failed to exist. But, you know, recessions are a natural and necessary part of the business cycle. You know, Joseph Schumpeter, the legendary economist that I've spoken about several times, you know, he came up with this idea of creative destruction. You know, obsolete firms get destroyed in this way. Capital is released, making way for new technologies, new businesses, like Google. And yet nobody's willing to apply Schumpeter's theory to the entire economy and admit that recessions are a natural part of the business cycle. You know, everyone instead persists in this kind of childlike fairy tale that all growth is good and that all recessions are bad, which is like, again, sort of a bad hangover of this 90s new economy ideology. You know, American investors' brain has sort of developed this blind obsession with growth at all costs, coupled with a sort of deadly fear of all recessions. Our values are distorted. You know, it's okay to be greedy and overshoot the market on the upside, grab too many assets, take on too much debt, make consumer spending a religion, live beyond our means, ignite hyperinflation along the way. Growth is good, even in excess. And yet recessions are the no-no that drives politicians and economists and investors ballistic. Well, here we have very, very quickly 17 reasons why we need to have recessions. One, purge the excesses of the housing boom, which we've discussed so often. Number two, it has to be a U.S. dollar wake-up call. Otherwise, this U.S. dollar problem will continue until the dollar reaches zero. Write-offs. We have to expose Wall Street's shallow banking system. You know, they're playing with $300 trillion in derivatives and still hiding over $100 billion of toxic off-balance sheet and asset-backed securities, plus another $300 billion hidden worldwide. You know, it's got to be written off. This is nonsense. It will never survive. It can never. It's nothing more than a cancer on the system. Number four, budgeting. Force fiscal restraint back into government. Number five, overconfidence. A recession has to wake up short-term investors playing the market. Number six, ratings. The ratings agencies have massive conflicts of interest, and they're not doing their job. They're supposed to represent the investors, but they favor corporate America, as we all know, which pays for these reports. They've got to be shaken up. Seven, China. We have to trigger an internal recession in China, make it realize America's not going into debt forever to finance China's domestic growth. Eight, oil. Force the energy and auto industries to get serious about emission standards and reducing oil dependency. Nine, inflation. Exposed core inflation farce Washington uses to sugarcoat reality. Number 10, moral hazard. Slow the Fed from cutting interest rates to bail out speculators. Number 11, war costs. Force Washington to get honest about how it's going to pay for these wars, other than supplemental bills that are worse than Enron-style debt financing. Number 12, CEO pay. We have to further expose this ridiculous compensation I've just been talking about for several days. It's now about 500 times the salaries of workers compared with about 40 times a generation ago. The new guy that just came in, John Thain, he's been there 4 days. He's already got himself a $44 million Christmas bonus. What's that all about? You know, 13, privatization. Stop the privatization of our federal government to no-bid contractors and high-priced mercenary armies fighting our wars. 14, entitlements. Force Congress to get serious about the coming Social Security Medicare disaster. With boomers now retiring, this problem can only get worse. A recession now would have been able to avoid a depression, but of course it won't. 15, consumers. Yes, we're all living way beyond our means, piling up excessive credit card debt, encouraged by government leaders who tell us deficits don't matter. Recessions will pressure individuals to reduce spending and increase savings. 16, regulation. Lobbyists have replaced regulation. Extreme theories of unrestrained free trade plus zero regulation just don't work. Proven by the credit crisis, hedge funds, non-disclosures, private equity taxation, rating agencies' failures, junk home mortgages, and more. Get real, folks. 17, sacrifice. We have not seen a nationwide decline in housing since this Great Depression, says Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf. As individuals and as a nation, Americans have always performed best in crises, like the Depression or World War II, times when we're all asked to make sacrifices. Pampering us with interest rate cuts and tax cuts during the Iraq and Afghan wars may have stimulated the economy temporarily, but they delayed the real damage of the 90s stock bubble while setting the stage for this new subprime credit crisis. Wake up, the train wrecked. Time to think positive, find solutions, demand sacrifices. Well, that's really where we come to. This is where we are at. This is now the end of 2007, and still the problems have not even begun to be addressed. Nobody sees them. Nobody wants to take care of them. What do we do? You know, where are we going with all this? You know, instead of which, you know, shareholders now are having their worst year since 2002. They're losing $74 billion of their equity. Wall Street is paying record bonuses, totaling almost $38 billion. You know, it's just nonsense. You know, they're all going to have to fall into line. You know, if they don't see the trouble coming, if these Wall Street people are giving you so much trouble, then frankly, they're going to have to get trouble the hard way, and they will. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Back with you in a week's time. Have a very happy Thanksgiving, and I will see you then. Bye-bye for now.